see where this particular section addresses the two concerns I think the tort reform package generally should address, and that is lowering insurance premiums and dealing with the, if you disagree with my characterization of the litigation explosion, the litigation costs, then I don't see how permitting additional recovery of money meets either of those two goals. Secondly, in reviewing this section, it presupposes that defendants are the only ones who refuse to settle cases. And that, to me, is unfair, and everybody who I've talked to and who's analyzed this couldn't understand what the basis was for that assumption. We spoke earlier about some empirical data. If there is any that says defendants are the only ones who refuse to settle cases, I'd like to see it. If this section were to have an additional provision that said if the plaintiff recovers less from a jury than the defendant offered, then the defendant would be entitled to attorney fees plus interest, then that would make this section equitable. Otherwise, it's just unfair. It doesn't take into account jury awards for future pain and suffering. It's difficult for me to understand why prejudgment, that is, before a jury determines what the amount of the actual injury is in a dollar sense, for that pain, suffering, loss of income that the injured party is going to sustain in the future, why interest on that amount should be awarded from the time the claim is filed, which, as at least we lawyers know, it's about 2 years in Multnomah County, a little bit less now, between the time of filing a complaint and the time the case gets to trial. So you're looking at 2 years' worth of interest, prejudgment interest. I guess we can't understand why, as to those claims which are prospective in nature, prejudgment interest should be awarded. From a practical standpoint, it's I haven't personally asked any judges what they think of this particular version of a bill that's been up before the House and Senate for a few years. My personal belief is that it would be horrendously difficult and take a lot of judicial time for a judge to try to unravel which portion of the award prejudgment interest should be allowed and which portion shouldn't. If you accept the concept that future pain, suffering, loss of income should not should also be a prejudgment interest on that amount should be awarded. The last time I looked, a personal injury award for pain and suffering was non-taxable. Now you add to that prejudgment interest, you're adding up the dollars for the plaintiff. The bill really doesn't take into account whatever interest there might be on the plaintiff's side in delaying the trial. For example, if the plaintiff's injuries are not stable, or a doctor has not determined yet what the extent of those injuries are, then doesn't it benefit the plaintiff to delay a resolution of that case, wait and not try the case until after they can have the doctor come in and testify as to the total extent of injuries?
Well, you could always make an offer of settlement.
So can the plaintiff.
Well, that's true. You're saying, though, that the plaintiff could delay the case. I'm saying, so the plaintiff wants to delay the case, so you, the defense lawyer, make an offer to the plaintiff, X number of dollars. And if the plaintiff doesn't recover that amount when the case is eventually tried, then the prejudgment interest would apply from the date of the filing.
And what happens if the amount awarded by the jury is less than the settlement offer?
Well, then there's no prejudgment interest paid there. mean, that, you know, your point about interest applying to prospective damages is a good point. I would say that that was probably task force oversight, that and that can be corrected quite easily. I don't know how the fact that the plaintiff wants to delay the case is going to hurt the defense or create more prejudgment interest, because all you have to do at any point in time is make an offer settlement, and if the plaintiff doesn't beat that offer with a jury award, why, there's no interest then.
Well, and I guess the concern then is, what is that offer of settlement based upon? Is it based upon plaintiff's admitted partial analysis of what his or her injuries really are? And if that's the case, if the plaintiff's condition isn't stable, do you expect the defendants to make an offer based upon that condition existing at that time? And if the offer is made and it turns out later on that the condition was more serious, then making the offer settlement, A, the plaintiff isn't going to accept it, and B, it won't do you any good if, in fact, the plaintiff recovers more. I guess the thrust of my question...
There's always an offer settlement made right up to the time the case is tried, oftentimes during the trial of the case. So if your offer was, you reassess the case, why, I assume you would make a more reasonable offer the day before the trial. And that's the offer that this would be tested against. It'd be your latest offer.
No, again, as I say, I don't represent casualty insurers, so I don't have a vested interest in this, but I hear the complaint about the insurance adjuster is that he's the one in the hospital trying to get the plaintiff to settle right away as soon as possible. And I think that's generally the philosophy that insurance defense lawyers and defense lawyers generally take. They want to try to settle the case as quickly and as soon as possible to reduce the costs. Whereas under this bill, I mean, that's one of the complaints I've heard about the industry. On the other hand, this bill would encourage the plaintiff to delay settling the case because of getting a prejudgment interest on an award. If the contingent fee of the plaintiff's lawyer is based upon that prejudgment interest...
You're reading a different bill than I'm reading. I mean, the whole purpose of this language, and I think it was practically unanimous in the task force, is that it would encourage settlements. That's the purpose of it. It would encourage settlements.
I'm all for that purpose, but I guess I don't see how putting the onus on the defendants encourages settlement.
The defendant's the one that's got the money, I suppose. That's the reason. Okay. So if you made an offer a day before trial, it was a reasonable offer, and the plaintiff didn't accept it and went to trial and didn't get any more than that, then, you know, there's no interest, of course.
I guess my
you might want to change the, maybe your suggestion that the timeline be changed from the date of filing to, say, the date of the offer.
No, I don't think I'm suggesting that. What I'm suggesting, I guess, is that I have difficulty placing the entire burden upon the defendants and imposing a penalty upon the defendants when I'm not convinced that it's the defendants who are at fault in settling a case. And merely because the defendant has the money doesn't prohibit both parties' right to their day in court before a jury to decide A, liability, and B, the amount of damages, if any. What you're forcing here is you're precluding the defendant his day in court by forcing, by imposing a penalty upon that defendant who may want to have his day in court to determine what the actual damages are. Another point, I guess, is that this section does not take into account the collateral source rule in Oregon as it exists. Oftentimes, much of the plaintiff's damages has been paid for example, a medical or health insurer, and the jury awards an amount that includes that payment. Now, is prejudgment interest going to be allowed on that portion of the award? And if so, to whom is it paid? Does it get paid back to the medical health insurer, even if there's no obligation on the part of the plaintiff to pay it back? talked about the question of contingent fee agreements, whether or not the prejudgment interest would be part of the contingent fee agreement. And then finally, the question is, will this really urge prompt resolution of claims, or will it merely add to the negotiating process another arrow in the quiver of the plaintiffs and the plaintiff's bar? And I think it's the latter. I don't think it will encourage prompt settlement. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you. Let's see. Tom, did you want to testify on this? See. John, you still want to testify on this? Okay. Jack? Where Jack goes? He's still here? Okay. You still want to testify? No?
It won't take long.
But you still want to testify? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I'm Tom Bessonette with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. This is one of those issues that perennial goes round and round and keeps coming back. I have no problem, and I'm testifying only on behalf of Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. We have absolutely no problem with out-of-the-pocket expenses by the plaintiff being reimbursed, not only the expenses that the jury awards, but also interest on that money that they have laid out. But we do feel it's an error to allow money to be collected on prospective injuries as well as the collateral source that has already been referred to. I have sat for about 20 years as a claims man and 10 years as a claims manager, so I've made a lot of the decisions on when we try, when we negotiate settlements and things of this nature. I might say to you that the information I have passed out to you, one of them is a study from the city or the state of Vermont that indicates the delay in settlements is on behalf of the plaintiff 83% of the time. The other study, and by the way, the same man, John Connelly, now works in the Salem area for the firm of Churchill, instigated a study through the Willamette Law School, and they studied Coos Bay and Coos County and Lane County, and they found out that the plaintiff attorneys also caused the extensive delay there. And as you will notice in the one-page handout, it indicated, as I recall, 8/10 of a year's delay in the trials was on behalf of the plaintiff. Now, if that's the case and you're charging 9% interest and you're talking about a $100,000 verdict, you're talking about $8,100 added cost to that case. Now, this...
Put that in the context of...
9% times 9/10 of a year, a full year would be $9,000 interest alone on a $100,000 case.
Plaintiff had been paid immediately what the jury ultimately thought the case was worth, the plaintiff could have invested it at the same interest rate.
That would be real interesting if we could, in fact, secure a demand from the plaintiff attorney that was reasonable. Right now, it's a situation where we're asked to give our top dollar, and they're not really asked to give their bottom dollar demand. Until the trial, as you've talked about, the day before the trial, those cases are expensive because they have cost us by the hour from the beginning of time, and the average time element, as you will notice in the Lane County cases, the average time of trial from the time the case was the average duration on page 6 is 757 days.
Mr. Chairman.
And a lot of that delay is caused by the plaintiff.
Some of that delay is certainly caused by plaintiff's lawyers who are serving as legislators. Senator Wyatt?
Yes. The thing I'm trying to understand here is, and I'm glad I didn't ask the previous witness because would have held things up twice as long or something, but since you bring it up again, I do need to ask you. Are you contending that the plaintiff's lawyer and working with his client or her client is going to is going to either overtly or covertly be induced to delay trying to get money because they're getting 9% interest when they could take that same money. You think there are people, and put it out at, I guess, Treasury bills are down around 5 or something now. Let's be fair about this. You know, maybe it's only 5 as compared to 9. Do you think there are people around who would rather have the possibility of some money out there that they're getting 9% on later, maybe, rather than the certainty of getting money now that they get 5 on?
No, I certainly agree with you on your analogy. I do not believe that they deliberately delay settlements trying to get 9% interest.
Okay. So you're saying the way the cases are being handled then is that the plaintiff's lawyers are delaying, and that that's unfair to the insurance company or other defendants because they have to end up paying.
That's correct.
Okay. Now I agree with you about that if the rest of your thing is right, but I just want to make sure you're not contending, because I thought the prior witness and what I read in here maybe was, and it's not fair to him to say that now after he got away. But you aren't saying that anybody's sitting back thinking, well, we're getting 9%
interest. Not for 9%
interest.
Let's
not go ahead and get the money now because we could only get 5 now and maybe get 9 later.
What I am trying to dispute, and I think I have given you case studies or studies that indicate that the delay that you've heard about in the past 3 or 4 sessions is not on the behalf of the defendant insurance company.
Well, I heard the fellow from Willamette make his presentation at a continuing legal education conference on litigation costs and delay, but I didn't get a chance to ask him a lot of questions there. But is it equal to say whether the plaintiff is delaying or the defendant is delaying when the plaintiff is the person who has the burden of proving the case and has to get all the medical evidence together before they can go to trial, whereas the defendant, with all due respect, can wait until that information is available and then decide if they want to get an independent medical or whatever. But if you know it's going to be 2 years to get to trial, which I don't quite agree it's 2 years, but let's take that figure, in Multnomah County, and you've got somebody who's getting better, but they're not completely well yet, you're foolish not to go ahead and file the complaint and get the medicals as you go along. And if it happens that you approach the trial date before everything's all ready, you go and get a postponement. Now, is that a lawyer delaying the case? I think it's a lawyer trying to get things moving as rapidly as possible, and if they unfold more quickly than they thought they were, then maybe they have to ask for a delay.
That's why earlier in my testimony I stated that out-of-the-pocket expenses paid by the plaintiff should be reimbursed, not only that, but also interest on that. But for the other expenses that have been paid or the other calculated expenses into the future should not be reimbursed interest on that caused because of the accident itself. In other words, it was nobody's responsibility that it took that leg so long to heal. It had to heal before the case should have been tried even. Because I won't talk about that. I heard something that I thought I would have said, it's a good malpractice case on behalf of an attorney to make a demand early and then the injuries deteriorate substantially.
I think the chairman was talking about the insurance. The defense lawyer could make the offer early, not that the plaintiff could make the demand early. But so what you're saying is that if a person has an injury that's going to take a while to heal, they should get all their out-of-pocket. And if they lose, if they're a worker and they lose time, they should get interest on that up to the time of trial.
If they haven't been reimbursed, yes. But if they've been reimbursed by anybody, I don't see why the collateral source benefits should inure to the benefit of the injured party in interest.
And then what are you saying about the injury to the leg, or say leg hypothetically? You shouldn't. What is it you shouldn't get about that?
From the time that it takes to heal the human body, which is different in every human body,
right,
determines sometimes the time that the settlement can be made. Because we cannot make that settlement, the plaintiff attorney should not continue that settlement until they're ready to be able to finalize properly the evaluation of that case. He can't evaluate it. I couldn't evaluate it from the medical information sent to me. But according to this, the time of interest is running all the way through from the time of the filing of the complaint, the claim, the claim, which might be the day after the accident, if they have made a claimant's report to us.
So until the patient is, the plaintiff is medically stationary, the prejudgment interest shouldn't start running on what?
On any of the collateral source benefits or the prospective injury, damages. The pain, suffering, et cetera.
Pain and suffering.
Yes, that. Or the wage loss in the future that will be paid immediately after the verdict is rendered.
Do you think these fairer definitions of it could be, are things that could be drafted?
I certainly do. And I'll be happy to work with staff to do it.
Are you finished?
Yes, I am.
Any questions, Mr.
Sorry, I only had one copy of the full Willamette study. They are available through the Willamette School.
Okay. John, Powell?
I can ask him.
Oh, you have a question?
No, I'm sorry. I can ask him.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Company. Just very briefly, and try not to reiterate some of the arguments that you've been given previously on the prejudgment interest question, but that is the only section of the so-called tort reform portion of this that we would like to comment on this time. And it would be to request that perhaps you give consideration to removing this particular section from Senate Bill 323, and if you choose to consider the issue, do so in a separate vehicle. Again, we have a hard time believing that this concept fits within the confines of the overall purpose of insurance affordability and availability, because we think clearly the facts that have been brought out in previous legislative debates would indicate that, in fact, it would be more costly to the process if prejudgment interest was added. I wanted to make just a couple comments in that it has been argued in previous sessions that the main purpose for prejudgment interest is to clear court dockets. I have not seen evidence of that. I know that part and parcel of this whole debate on insurance affordability and availability is prove to me before we do it what the reduction in premium is going to be. You've been told that's impossible, and I agree with that finding. But I think the same thing is true to a certain extent here. There are states that have had prejudgment interest and had it for some time. The information that State Farm has provided me would indicate that, in fact, there are more suits pending in their study in 12 prejudgment interest states than in non-prejudgment interest states, and I've asked them to provide me with additional information in that area. The future loss question has been raised, that part of the judgment is for future losses, and why should that apply? I think that is a very valid concern. Something that has not been mentioned so far this evening, and I think points to the fact that this will add cost to the system, is that the bill that was introduced and passed last session had a fiscal impact to the state of over $1 million in that biennium and over $2 million to the cities of the state of Oregon in that biennium. So I think it is clear from at least that analysis that you can assume that insurance premiums will have to rise if prejudgment interest is enacted. So,
Senator Cohen.
I didn't realize that the overall prejudgment interest bill that got passed, that you say passed the last session. I'm not. It was
vetoed, Senator Cohen.
And then it didn't really have an impact because it didn't get implemented.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, that was the fiscal analysis that accompanied the bill that I referred to.
Any other questions, Mr. Powell? All right, thanks. I'd say I think I tend to agree with John's thought that maybe this really is doesn't fit in well with the rest of this package. I'll have to tell the committee members I didn't think so at the time either, but here it is, and we might want to consider whether it should be a separate somewhere else, in or out of this thing. Okay, Jack, come on up. Especially if it's one of those things we're going to argue about, might as well take it out.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Monroe, appearing here today on behalf of the American Insurance Association. One of the advantages of being last, obviously, is that there's probably very little ground that hasn't been turned yet. Really, Mr. Richter made all of the points that I had wanted to make, and John Powell took the last one that had been untouched, which was the fact that this language, while it, I think we tend to think of it in terms of insurance companies and whatnot, does apply to self-insured entities, including public bodies, and John pointed that out with the fiscal impact statement from the last session. One of the things that, and I guess maybe the only question that I might raise, one of the things that I find interesting, I guess, in reading the language in this proposed section is that it tends to be vague in a number of different senses, or at least it appears to me to be vague in a number of different senses. The language, for example, is really silent on what constitutes a settlement demand. And while, for example, we might think of it and contemplate it in terms of it being a written demand, it really doesn't seem to require it. The other thing that I find interesting, and I guess maybe I pose it as a question, I have to assume that because the term settlement demand is undefined, that it might well include demands that are made both prior to the actual filing of the case and after. And it seems to me, depending upon which scenario you work with, that it might lead to different inequities. It also, I guess, along the consistent with the vague question of whether or not the language is vague theme, I also would simply raise the question, I guess, that Mr. Richter also posed, and that is, it really isn't clear to me what's included in the award, whether costs and disbursements and other things are to be included. And that's, I guess, maybe a separate issue than the issue that was also raised earlier about whether we're talking about both economic and non-economic damages or future damages, as was mentioned earlier. I have no other comments.
Any questions? Senator Hill.
It's not a question to Jack, Mr. Chairman. I guess I was not on the interim committee, and I wanted to ask, was there any thought given to leaving the whole subject of prejudgment interest to the discretion of the judge?
No.
And the reason I mention it is because if it can be a tool that would allow the judge to manage the case, it's always something that the judge can hold over both parties, I would suspect, to move things along. It's impossible in a statute to deal with all of the things that come in. And it is a tool that the judge can always have to say, move it along, and also take into account these various situations that occur that could mitigate or enhance prejudgment interest.
That wasn't really discussed in the task force. I don't know as this subject was very thoroughly discussed in the task force either. There is one more section, Section 10, and I know that Kip, were you going to argue about the need for clear language in a contingent fee agreement, or do you kind of agree with that concept? Okay, all right. I think that we've covered the agenda then, and I don't know how that fits in with the purpose of this bill either, frankly, but who can quarrel with that idea? Anything else, committee members? Well, I thought if we took prejudgment interest out of this thing that everybody would agree to send it out then. All right. Well, it's 7:02 and we'll be adjourned.